So today we're going to look at chapter 36 of the book, Living with an Open Heart. I think there's another title, An Open-Hearted Life. I'm looking at one that has the title Living with an Open Heart, but it's the same book. So this the topic for this chapter is the importance of regular practice. And this chapter is actually written by Russell Coltz. So it's written from the point of view of psychology, a psychologist, but it was really nice to see there's so much in common between what he's saying and what we say in Buddhism. And also when I was flipping through the book, because I don't think I've actually read every page of it, right at the beginning, in fact, it's, what is it, the introduction? Yeah, the introduction of the book is this wonderful story. You've probably heard it before, but it doesn't hurt to hear it again. It's a story from the Native American tradition. It's actually called a legend, a Native American legend. So it goes like this. An old Cherokee is teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside me, he said to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. So that's one of the wolves. And the grandfather continued, the other wolf is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. So there's this fight between these two wolves, and he says, this is happening inside of me, but this same fight is going on inside of you and inside of every other person as well. The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, which wolf will win? The old Cherokee simply replied, the one you feed. So I know a lot of Buddhist teachers, for example, Pema Chodron, have used this story as an illustration of the importance of spiritual practice. I think we can all relate to this fight going on inside of us. And, you know, there's the side of us or the aspects of our mind that are really disturbing and painful and sometimes downright ugly and harmful. And then there are other aspects of our mind that are really beautiful and wonderful. All the positive thoughts and feelings and love and kindness and compassion and peacefulness and joy and so forth. And sometimes one is stronger, sometimes the other is stronger. And we may feel as if we have no choice, we have no control over this. But as this story illustrates, that's not true. Yeah, we can feed. We have to decide which of these two sides, these two aspects, we prefer and we're more comfortable with. And then we can feed that one. And hopefully we'll choose the wolf that represents all the positive qualities. And that's really what this book is all about, is how to have more compassion, more love, more peacefulness, more joy, better relationships with others, and so on. But if we want that to happen, we have to put some effort into it. We can't just wait for those positive qualities to pop up. I mean, sometimes they will. They will just pop up on their own, spontaneously. But if we just wait for that, then, you know, they might be few and far between. And the other ones, the disturbing negative ones, will also pop up a lot. So we do have some choice there. We do have a certain amount of control over what comes up in our mind, what kind of thoughts and feelings. And we can feed the positive qualities so that they increase more and more. Okay, so chapter 36 says, a number of times, meaning in this book, a number of times we have mentioned the importance of making time each day for practice. Time to reconnect with your true values and to build a sense of meaning in your life. It's important to shift out of the hustle and bustle mode of getting things done and create space in our lives to connect with our own experience and priorities. Even if we welcome our work, family, and leisure activities and find them rewarding, it can be easy to drift away from our core values and again begin to move through life like we're checking items off our list. Does that sound familiar? I think many people make a to-do list, and it's on paper or in your tablet or your phone or whatever. But I find also there's a reflection of that in my own mind. I have this sense, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that. And sometimes we don't really give ourselves enough time and space to, as he's saying, reconnect with what our real values are. And as Buddhist practitioners, we're advised to begin our day with some spiritual practice and generate a positive motivation, a positive aspiration for what we're going to do during our day, but also in a bigger sense in our life, what it is we really want to do with our time and energy in this life, in this world, and then try to make that our motivation for everything that we do. But it's so easy to forget that, lose sight of that, get caught up in the busyness of our life and checking things off our to-do list and lose touch with our real motivation. So he says, if this happens, it can create stress, exhaustion, and a gradual erosion of our sense of purpose and compassion. Over time, we can find ourselves grumbling and feeling resentful of all we have to do. Well, that probably also sounds familiar. And when I was reading this, I remembered reading this article. I think I was preparing a talk on compassion burnout or compassion fatigue, and I found this article online written by a doctor, and he described how this had happened to him. I'm sure every person who goes into the healthcare profession to be a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, psychologist does so with a sense of compassion. Really want to help people. I want to relieve suffering, save lives, and so on. But then with all the work involved, I mean, just the study, you know, the incredible study and the time and energy that goes into that job, and not a whole lot of free time to kind of relax and regenerate your energy. So sometimes the sense of compassion can kind of decline and even get lost. And so he described how this happened to him, and he told the story of one patient he had. He was getting so angry at this patient because the patient had some kind of lung problem. I don't think it was lung cancer, maybe emphysema, is that it? You know, difficulty breathing. And he was a smoker. And so, you know, he'd come in and, you know, need help. The doctor would help him, but, you know, try to tell him, now you got to stop smoking. And the guy knew that, but he couldn't stop. He kept going back to smoking and then kept getting sick again and having to come in for help. So the doctor was just getting really frustrated, really angry at this patient, which, I mean, he knew that wasn't good. But he talked to a colleague who helped him, you know, reconnect with his compassion. And what he did with this patient was to ask him, now, why is it that you keep smoking? And the patient said, I've just got so much stress in my life, my son, this and this and this, my job, this and this and this, my neighbor, this and this. So he's just having all these really stressful experiences in his life. And he had this habit of smoking. Smoking gave him some relief to his stress. And so he knew it wasn't helpful, but he just kept going back into it because of other factors in his life. So when the doctor heard what was lying behind the patient's addiction to cigarettes, his mind softened. He was able to regain his compassion for his patient. So he realized that, you know, it's really important to, you know, reconnect with your compassion. Try to understand people, listen to them and so on, which is one of the best ways to generate compassion or renew our compassion. So anyway, that was just an illustration of how he needed to kind of make some changes in the way he was approaching his work and his patients. And he also talked about the importance of taking time for himself to make sure he does reconnect with his compassion, his motivation. So I'm sure this is happening a lot now with COVID, and I mean, the amount of stress and overtime and lack of support experienced by doctors and nurses and so on. And I don't know how they do it, but I just really hope they do find the time to take care of themselves and take care of their compassion. So that's very much needed. So then he goes on to say, when this happens, when we find ourselves grumbling and feeling resentful about everything we have to do, our experience is telling us that it's time to slow down, create some space to relax and to connect with our better qualities and to re-engage with the things that give our lives a sense of purpose and meaning. We don't have to wait until we're feeling burned out, though. Establishing practice as a regular habit can help us avoid getting overwhelmed in the first place. Whether you think of these practices as spiritual mind training or simply as taking your mind to the gym, the key is to slow down and create space in your daily life to reconnect with yourself, your values, and what you ultimately want your life to be about. So it can be helpful to just have a better understanding of how the mind works. Like in Buddhism, we say the mind is a complex continuum of different thoughts and feelings and emotion that's always changing every minute, every second. So it's like a flow, a stream, a river made up of all these experiences. And so it's kind of flowing from the past to the future. And the experiences that we had in the past recur. They come up again and again and again. And we can have a certain amount of control over this by deliberately generating positive thoughts and positive feelings, which is what we do in meditation. And that's actually the meaning of meditation. The word for meditation in Buddhism, in Tibetan language is gom, which literally means familiarize. So that's what we're doing when we're meditating. We are familiarizing our mind with states of mind, thoughts, feelings, experiences that are positive, that are constructive, that are beneficial. Like compassion. When we sit down and do meditation on compassion, even if it's just for 5 minutes, we're familiarizing our mind with that way of thinking and that way of feeling. And, you know, we keep doing that again and again and again, and it gets more and more habitual, more and more our natural way of thinking and feeling. And pretty soon it just starts coming up by itself. I mean, that's my experience. You know, in the beginning, I had to really make a lot of effort to feel compassion and loving kindness and so on. It didn't arise very easily or naturally. But after a while, I started noticing, wow, it's just coming up by itself without making any effort. Not as much as I would like to, unfortunately, but at least I could see. You put effort into generating those thoughts and feelings, and pretty soon they are coming up just by themselves. So that's how the mind works. And so, you know, it can be talked of in terms of like familiarizing or habituating our mind. Or another way of talking about it is planting seeds. which is a nice kind of simple analogy. You know, if you want certain types of plants to grow in your garden, like vegetables, flowers, you got to put the seeds in. You can't expect to just sit there and look at your garden. I would like some daisies here, and I would like some tomatoes over there, and just hope that they're going to arise by themselves. It's crazy. You got to put the seeds and take care of them, water them, take out the weeds, and make sure that they grow well. So it's similar with our mind. Our mind is like a garden. And if we want good thoughts and feelings like compassion and love and joy and so forth to grow in our mind, we've got to make some effort. We've got to plant the seeds and take care of those seeds so they don't die through lack of water or get choked by weeds or get, you know, eaten up by the other wolf. Yeah. So that's how it's talked about in Buddhism. And then in science, like neuroscience, they talk about neural pathways. I don't know much about that, but I read about it in, for example, this lovely book called Buddha's Brain by Rick Hansen, who's both a meditator and a meditation teacher and a neuroscientist, neuropsychologist. So it's a lovely book about how, you know, the brain works in terms of meditation and making ourselves familiar with positive states of mind. So they talk about neural pathways. So for some people, that might be a more comfortable language, creating new neural pathways in your brain. But it's basically the same thing, just different language. So this is how our mind works. So this is how our brain works. Whatever we are most familiar with is what will arise most frequently and naturally and easily. So if we want the positive thoughts and feelings to come up more and more and more, we've got to, you know, plant those seeds or create those neural pathways. That's just how it works. Okay, then he goes on. It can be tempting to put off such practice because so many things seem to be demanding our attention. But if we don't make working with our minds a priority, it's unlikely we'll create lasting change. My, meaning Russell's, son has noticed the difference in me when I keep up with my practice and when I don't. He says, "Dad, you need to go meditate so you won't be so grumpy." I've heard that from other people as well. You know, their family members will make comments about, you know, if they're doing better or not doing so well. So they can see a difference whether they meditate or not. It's like maintaining a healthy body. We may fend off obesity by occasionally going through phases of exercise and healthy eating, but we won't make much progress in terms of getting in shape. Yeah. So just like with our body, we might go on a diet and do exercise for a month or two. And then if we stop that and go back to our old habits, you know, whatever benefit we experienced during that phase will disappear. So it's something we have to do regularly. Waiting too long between sessions, we lose the progress we've made and we end up just spending our time making it up again. So that we say that in Buddhism as well, that if you really want to make progress in your practice of meditation, it's something you have to do regularly. You can't just do it occasionally when you feel like it, you know, once a month and then, you know, months go by and you don't do it again. And that happens sometimes. People have these spurts of energy and they'll do a lot of practice in a short period of time and then, you know, go back to not doing any practice at all. And then maybe after a few months, they start again. It just doesn't work. We have to make regular progress. And it doesn't need to be a long period of time. It doesn't have to be like an hour a day or even 30 minutes a day. Mama Yeshe once said, even just 5 minutes a day is good. It's doing something. It's planting some seeds in your mind, creating some familiarity with positive thoughts and feelings. So everybody should be able to find 5 minutes a day to take care of your mind. The more, the better, of course. But, you know, if we're really busy, even just a few minutes can make a difference. The easiest way to establish a consistent practice routine is to allocate a time to do it every day and to make that a part of our nature. This may be a challenge to start with, but it will become easier as your routine becomes established. For example, I do my mindfulness and compassion meditation in the mornings for a half hour right before breakfast, unless I'm really starving when I wake, in which case I'll eat a bite, a bit of something first. So morning is a good time for a number of reasons. For one thing, provided we did have a good night's sleep, our mind is refreshed. There's like refreshed new energy, and it's relatively calm and clear compared to the end of the day. You know, if you had a really long, busy day, then your mind might be full of lots of, leftovers from the day. Arguments you're still carrying on with somebody, or hurt feelings you're still holding on to, or whatever. Just a lot more static going on in the mind later in the day. So then it can be harder to focus when you're meditating. So usually the mind in the early morning is more calm and clear and quiet. The environment is also more quiet, not as much noise and disturbance. So it's easier to find a quiet space in your mind. And it's also a really good way to start your day. If you can start your day with some practice and get your mind into a good state, then there's a greater chance of keeping your mind in a good state for the rest of the day. But I know some people say, I'm not a morning person. My mind works better in the evening. So, I mean, it's not absolutely necessary you have to do your practice in the morning. Some people might feel like they're just totally like a zombie when they first wake up in the morning, and only later their mind gets more alert and fresh. So you can do your practice anytime, whatever suits you, your particular state of mind, your level of energy, your schedule, and so on. So anytime can work. In doing this, it's important to consider obstacles that might get in the way. Ask yourself, what could get in the way of me doing my regular practice? For example, my routine requires that I get to bed at a reasonable hour. If I stay up too late, I'll be exhausted at that moment when my alarm goes off, and I'll be tempted to set it ahead 30 minutes and use my meditation time to get a little extra sleep. Going to bed on time sounds easy, but it requires a lot of discipline, as I like those few hours in the evening after my child is in bed. That's my free do whatever I want time, and I cherish it. But I know that if I make it to bed at a reasonable hour, I'll be much more likely to get up and practice, which makes all aspects of my life better. Yeah, so I find that too. If I get to bed too late, then mind is groggy in the morning, and I may oversleep and then not have enough time to do my practices. So you may need to make changes, adjustments in your routine, your schedule, in order to make sure you do have that time, whether it's in the morning or at another time of the day, and really cherish that time for your spiritual practice. Another potential obstacle to practice is time. Sometimes we may think there's just not enough time to practice. One way to tell if this is true is to get a daily planner that breaks the days into hourly units and spend a week recording what you do each hour. When we actually record our activities in this way, we often find lots of time spent surfing the internet, watching television, or texting. In this case, we can reallocate some of that time to create 20 to 30 minutes time for practice. Yeah, so I think that's really good advice. Because, yeah, if we do think, oh, I don't have time, I don't have time. But if you really look carefully at what you're doing, how you are spending your time, you might find there's some things you're doing that are not particularly beneficial or productive and could be used better to do something to benefit your mind. And by benefiting your mind, you will benefit all the other aspects of your life, your relationships with other people, your ability to do your work effectively, and so on and so forth. And of course, have more positive qualities in your mind, making the whole quality of your life much better. And again, like Lama Yeshe said, you know, even doing 5 minutes of meditation. So even if you are super, super busy, like the doctors and nurses right now who are just totally flat out taking care of people suffering from COVID, maybe they can still find some time to do meditation. It could be, you know, when they are taking a break or when they're traveling. And also meditation isn't necessarily sitting like this, you know, with your eyes closed, focusing on your breath or focusing on compassion or something. There are other ways to acquaint your mind with compassion. For example, when you are, if you are traveling, driving yourself or traveling on a bus or train to and from work, you can listen to teachings. There's so much available right now. Teachings that are nourishing your mind, helping you to have a more positive state of mind. I just, you know, just recently I read something by a person who, you know, would get very angry while driving and in the Bay Area, which is quite understandable. And so he started putting CDs in his car and listening to the Dalai Lama and Venerable Children and whoever, you know, various teachers. And he would enjoy so much listening to these beautiful words of wisdom and compassion that he almost didn't want to get out of his car afterwards. But, and it really helped him. He could really see how listening to these teachings was helping him to have more patience, more kindness, more compassion, less likely to get angry, to have road rage coming up. So this is another way, you know, to familiarize our mind with compassion by listening to teachings, which you can do anytime, even when you're driving, or reading books, reading spiritual teachings in books. So, you know, some people find meditating hard. Yeah, it may not suit their personality to sit still with their eyes closed and focus their mind. So that may not work for everybody, but there are other ways of acquainting our minds with compassion and kindness and generosity and so on. Reading, listening, also doing things, doing volunteer work. This is another way to, you know, increase our compassion. So he's talking here about obstacles to practice. So if we do find it difficult to have the discipline to do some kind of practice every day, then it can be helpful to look at why. What is preventing me from doing that? And try to overcome those obstacles. In the Buddhist teachings on the development of calm abiding or serenity, this is the ability to keep our minds focused single-pointedly on an object we choose, such as the breath or an image of the Buddha. So there's a whole set of teachings on how to increase the amount of time we're able to keep our mind focused until eventually, you know, there's no limit. You can just keep your mind focused in a very clear, sharp state of concentration for a long period of time, as long as you want. And it said that this kind of practice requires a lot of energy, a lot of time, a lot of, you know, determination. And there's various obstacles that come in the way. And the very first obstacle that we have to deal with is laziness. And there's different kinds of laziness. Laziness can mean different things. But in this case, it refers to just not wanting to practice. The state of mind that says, I don't feel like it. I don't want to do it. And this is another obstacle that you know, people might encounter in this context as well. Yeah, I know it's good to have compassion and generate compassion and work on generating compassion. I just don't feel like it. And then we can find all kinds of excuses, other things to do that are more interesting, more, you know, enjoyable than sitting down and meditating on compassion. So it's said that that obstacle, you know, is a big one, because if you can't even get yourself to do it, to sit down and meditate or to open a book and read or listen to a teaching, then you're not giving yourself the conducive conditions to be able to enhance your compassion, increase your compassion. So it said that the antidote to that particular problem of laziness, the term used is faith. But faith here doesn't mean like faith in some external deity. Rather, faith in the positive consequences, the results we will experience by doing this practice. So in other words, if we can really see the benefit that we will experience by generating more compassion or whatever practice we may be doing, if we can see there's some good results that I will get by doing this, that will give us the energy, the enthusiasm to carry on with our practice. So in the beginning, it may be hard to have that kind of faith or belief or trust in the benefit of the practice because we haven't yet done it. So we have to put some energy to start with. We have to try it out. And hopefully we will get some good results. We will notice that we are becoming more calm and more kind, more patient, more compassionate. And if we can see those results, then that will give us the trust, we might say, trust to keep going. If I keep doing this more and more and more, then my mind will improve even more. So we do have to be willing initially to try it out before we can even experience those results. But it could also be helpful to listen to the stories of others and also to see in others the results of practice. So, you know, if we can see that there are other people who have been practicing this for a period of time, and we can see how kind they are, how patient they are, how compassionate they are, that could also give us more a sense of trust in the benefits of this practice. So find some way of convincing yourself, becoming convinced of the benefits of generating more compassion, and then think, okay, if I work on this more, then my compassion will grow more and more. Okay, going back to the book, and he was talking about time. Sometimes it is true that we don't have any free time. We're just racing from one activity to the next, from the moment we get up until we collapse into our beds. Probably now with the healthcare workers dealing with COVID. If this is indeed the case, we need to address it. We won't be able to sustain this pace over time and also be at our best. If we want to develop qualities like compassion, we have to make it a priority. This may mean making tough choices about what we have to eliminate to make space for our practice. That said, we suspect you've made plenty of tough choices in your life already in order to pursue things that were important to you. In comparison to the rest of our hectic lives, our relatively quiet practice may feel unproductive, as if nothing is getting done. We don't have anything kind of physical, material to show for the time we're practicing. This is a mistaken perception, a product of an overly busy mind. We've trained our minds to believe that being productive means being busy, But they are not the same thing. This busyness can keep us stressed out and block our compassion. Mind training practices involve slowing down and doing things such as focusing attention on our breath, creating compassionate imagery in our minds, or reading materials that inspire us and deepen our understanding. This slowing down is not laziness. It is a basic building block of compassion and sanity. Becoming friends with ourselves, cultivating compassion, and generating wisdom take time and dedication. Establishing a regular practice is the surest way to do that. So it also seems there's more and more research done on the benefits of meditation, like mindfulness meditation, but also compassion. And this research seems to be ongoing. So there's more evidence, more and more evidence, scientific evidence of the benefits of these kind of practices. So if you pay attention to those, read, you know, about those, and that could be another source of seeing the value of these kinds of practices, even though there may not be any, you know, hard material results you can see in your life, but just the inner results. Another thing too, I don't know if it's talked about in this book, I haven't read the whole thing, but this is something we talk about in Buddhism, and it's certainly very, very relevant. And that is the time of death. We're all going to die one day. And the time of our death is a very important time, very crucial time. From the Buddhist point of view, it's because death is not an end of everything, but it's just a doorway, a gateway to another life. There's a continuation of our mind, our consciousness, after we die, and we will have another life with another set of circumstances. And the state of mind we have at the time of death is a very crucial one for determining where we go, what kind of life we have, what kind of experiences we have in our next life. So it's very, very important to die with a positive state of mind, not a mind full of fear, anxiety, anger, resentment. This does happen. People are angry at the time of death. I haven't actually seen it myself, but I've heard of it. They can be angry that they're dying, angry at their doctors, angry at their family members who didn't do what they wanted them to do, or just the fact that they are healthy and you are not. So there can be various, you know, reasons for feeling angry at the time of death. So it'd be very, very unfortunate to die with such a state of mind. This would not bode well for the next life. But even for people who don't believe in another life after this one, who believe that death is just the end of everything, still, I'm sure if they were asked, how would you like your mind to be at that time? Would you like to be freaked out, full of fear, angry? Angry at everybody around you, throwing things, screaming at people? I mean, that's not a nice way to go. So I'm sure, you know, people would like to have a calm, peaceful mind at that time and have feelings of love and compassion and kindness for the family members and friends who are around at that time. The state of mind we have at that time depends on the state of mind we have as we go through life. What it is we are most familiar with during our life. If we are familiar with anger and selfishness and greed and always being unsatisfied with everything, if those are the types of thoughts we have as we go through life, the ones we are most familiar with, those are what will arise at the time of death. So it's just a result of how we live our life. And if we want to have a positive state of mind and, you know, peaceful and calm and have good thoughts and good feelings in our mind at that time, we need to acquaint ourselves with those as we go through life. And so this is another thing to consider to understand the importance of spiritual practice, to acquaint ourselves with positive states of mind as much as we can during our life. And I'll just read something from a book, my favorite books about death and dying by Christine Longacre, called Facing Death and Finding Hope. So she's a woman who worked, at the time she wrote this book, she'd already had 20 years of experience working with dying people. And so she has, you know, genuine firsthand experience of what helps and what doesn't. And she's also a spiritual practitioner. So just a quote from her book about the importance of doing spiritual practice to prepare for death. She says, every religious tradition emphasizes that to prepare spiritually for death, it is vital that we establish right now a daily spiritual practice, a practice so deeply ingrained that it becomes part of our flesh and bones, our reflexive response to every situation in life, including our experiences of suffering. Yeah, so there are many stories of people, both highly accomplished spiritual practitioners, but also just ordinary people who have very deep faith and have really lived their lives according to the teachings, the advice of their respective spiritual tradition, and at the time of death are very calm and peaceful and even joyful and able to have positive thoughts and feelings and not fear and anger. So that's the end of the chapter, and there's just a short reflection which I'll read. Think about how you could establish a regular schedule for your compassion practice, considering your daily activities and anticipating obstacles that might get in the way. Make up a timetable and try to follow it. If it doesn't work, figure out what factors got in the way and alter the schedule so that it better fits your needs. It may take several tries to find a schedule you are able to follow consistently. After a period of regularly engaging in practice, the benefits of doing so become clear, and keeping to your schedule becomes much easier. If you're wondering what exactly to do during your practice time, contemplating the ideas featured in these entries makes for a good start. Yeah, so at the end of every chapter, there's some reflections on how to have more compassion. So you can just go through those and do one at a time. Pick an entry and spend time thinking about it and how you might be able to apply the ideas in your life. I know this is a hot topic when I'm teaching. People often talk about how, yeah, I really want to do a daily practice, but it's so hard to do, how to do it. Okay, so let's dedicate.